The whole purpose of this was only to give you a glimpse of what the argument is for the need of a Calabi-Yau manifold and how complex manifolds arise, and why we spend 1 hour on Monday discussing them. Okay. But these are all topics that one has to sit down and study more carefully. And the last thing that I want to say about this is that people have not only tried to compactify on a six-dimensional manifold like this, just for the sake of understanding the theory, people also have considered manifolds of the form. Okay? Just compactifying on a four-dimensional manifold that is not a torus, and seeing what are the requirements you need in order to get some unbroken supersymmetry. Now here the story is interesting because it's fascinating that everything fits together, because the most general polynomial group of SO4, of a four-dimensional manifold is SO4. But remember, SO4, when we studied Lie algebras, was actually something that can be written as the direct product of two Lie algebras. You remember the Dynkin diagram was something like this. So this is isomorphic to SU2 plus SU2. And now imagine that you take the holonomic group of this guy and you assume that it's actually equal to just this guy. Okay? So you take the holonomic group to just be this SU2 and not this one. So a spinner that transforms under this part would be covariantly constant. So a two complex dimensional manifold that is scalar with SU2 holonomy will also do the job. You remember on Monday we also said that there were Calabi-Yau two folds. There were Calabi-Yau three folds like that, and there were Calabi-Yau two folds. And we said that they were called K3. Now there is a funny story of why these are called K3, but I'm not sure it's true, so I won't tell you. At least not on break.
Question.
Yeah.
You said the most general holonomy group would be SO4.
Yeah.
And that's under the assumption, I guess, that you have a metric compatible connection.
Yeah, I'm always assuming that. Yes.
Yeah. This is the way I should think about it.
Yeah. We discussed all that on Monday. When we did. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Now, have we succeeded in finding our goal? Sadly, no. Yeah, so why am I smiling? Yeah, you might wonder. What? Well, the answer is no, because out of the 32 supercharges, okay, when we compactify on a Calabi-Yau threefold here, remember, the 32 supercharges were 16 plus 16. And when we compactify on a Calabi-Yau threefold, we break three quarters of the supersymmetries, because we only preserve one out of the four guys. And therefore, out of each of the 16, we get four supercharges. So sadly, we get eight supercharges. And when we do this, with the SU2 holonomy, we preserve one whole guy. Remember, this was SU2 plus SU2. So out of the two supercharges, one is broken, the other one is completely preserved. So we get 16 supercharges. Well, this is not surprising. We are not going all the way down to four dimensions. Almost everything is flat, nice and flat. And only four dimensions are compactified on something interesting. So we break half of the supersymmetries. And here we break all the way to 8, but we want 4. So we have to work harder, I have to say. Well, as some people would say, don't work harder, just work smarter, right? So in order to find out what to do, let's go back to surprisingly, the bosonic system. Okay, the clue for what we have to do will be in the bosonic string. And the reason we want to go back to the bosonic string is that we want to understand more deeply toroidal compactifications. Okay.
Excuse me, Freddie.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just the subscript there on CY.
3-4. Calabi-Yau 3-4. Remember, I told you that there are hundreds of thousands of Calabi-Yau 3-4s. People have found many, many, many of them. But Calabi-Yau 2-4s, they have found only, in fact, they know that there are only two, a torus and a K3. So this is a non-trivial example of a Calabi-Yau 2-4. Whatever K3 means, I haven't told you, so don't worry about that. If you want to know, it's a quartic in CP3. But we can discuss that more carefully. Like a Calabi-Yau 3-4, an example, it's a quintic in CP4. But we can do that more carefully later. Perhaps tomorrow, if you want to. So let's do the bosonic string. And let's take it on an S1. This is something you did in the tutorial, right? So we're going to do the closed bosonic string, not even the open. Just let's consider the closed. So this is only a review of what you did already. So the modus function, you'd say, well, this looks terribly boring. After doing all these deep brains and all these things, we're going back to the oscillators. But the reason will be clear in a second. What were N and M? Do you remember? What was M? Anyone? Is M? What was the name? It was a number. Which number?
Winding
the winding number. Very good. So this was the winding number. And some people call this the Kaluza-Klein number, just to give it a name. But this was from the momentum of the object. The wave function, the momentum had to be quantized for the wave function to be single value. Now, allow me to call this P left and this P right, this whole combination. The reason is that it would save some writing, and it would generalize nicely when we compactify on more dimensions. Okay, so remember the mass spectrum, you also work out, let's forget about alpha prime. So you found that it was something like this. The spectrum of the theory can be determined from this formula. Now the level matching condition implies that now the oscillators don't have to be exactly the same. Okay? Remember, without winding, we had that N tilde acting on a state had to be equal to N, but now they can differ by this quantity, which is equal to the product of winding times the Kaluza-Klein number. Okay? This is just a review. And the spectrum, I think this is new. You didn't do the spectrum in the tutorial, I don't believe. So what do you get? So imagine that we call I the indices from 0 to 24. Okay. So we have the usual oscillator modes. acting on the vacuum. And these guys gave us the dilaton, the B field, and the metric. Okay. However, we know we can also have other states by putting here the 25th direction, right? Well, we could also have the 25th direction on this side, but remember, just the straightforward entries in these 26 times 26 dimensional metrics. Well, we can do it. We can do it like this, or yeah, this is fine. No, maybe we should not. Yeah. Let's do everything in the Lycon quantization, okay? So Lycon quantization means that we are collecting two of these coordinates and getting rid of the term, okay? Still, we're going to keep this 25 as being the S1 that we're compactifying, okay? So remember, these indices, I, these are only the transverse oscillations. So we're going to do 1, 2, all the way to 23. That looks a little bit funny, but the reason is that the 24th direction is combining with the zero direction to be the Lycon coordinates, and the S1 is the 25th direction. Okay. Now, we know that these metrics, we did something interesting to this metric, in order to have something nice under SO24, the little group. Okay. And we decompose this metric, the big metric, into anti-symmetric part, the symmetric part, and the trace. So we should also keep the same idea here. Okay. So these are the states we're missing from these ones here that gave rise to this. And these states are what? Well, these are the symmetric and the anti-symmetric parts. So it looked like B mu 25 and G mu 25. Okay? Now, what are these guys? These guys are now vector bosons, massless vector bosons. So we have, when we compactify in a circle, our closed string develops a U1 plus U1 gauge symmetry. So when you compactify in a circle, remember, this is like the Kaluza-Klein idea. His idea was, or their idea, was that gravity in five dimensions could give rise in four dimensions when you compactify in a circle to a U1 gauge field. And at the time, they only knew about long-range forces that were gravity and electromagnetism. So they thought they were done just by doing that. Here, we have a string theory. So we also have the B field, and that's why we get another U1. So when we compactify in a circle, we get a U1, cross U1, okay? But remember, the string theory sees space-time in a funny way. You should remember that phrase from the tutorial. What was the funny thing that happened? We discussed that today in the morning. In the context of type 2 theories, but you did that. Well, the thing that happens in a string theory that you don't have in point particles is that you have winding. And it was winding that tells you that there is a symmetry in this theory. Okay? What was the symmetry? You could exchange winding with KK modes, right? And what happened? The bosonic string, as you try to compactify it and make the radius of the circle very, very small, what happens to the string? What is the theory telling you?
Yeah, its winding number becomes its mass and vice versa.
That if it becomes a theory that is identical to a theory with an inverse radius, in such a way that the winding gets exchanged with a Kaluza-Klein number, okay? And therefore, the space of inequivalent string theories on a circle was not the whole real line, the positive real line of radius of compactification. So for a point particle, precisely what Kaluza-Klein did, the space of compactifications is called R plus, right? Meaning all positive numbers, all values of the radius of compactification. For the string, what is the possible space of compactifications? Do you remember? Do we have the whole space of inequivalent theories? For a point particle, every point here, every different radius, give you a different theory. For the string theory, that didn't happen. Because as you try to compactify it on a smaller and a smaller radius, there is a special point called, say, R critical, or the self-dual radius, such that if you pass through this point, and you start going here, you get theories that are equivalent to theories that you already studied, okay? Because winding and Kaluza-Klein momentum gets swapped. So as you go here to a smaller radius, you get theories that are equivalent to theories here. So you're supposed to extract this and say that your space of inequivalent theories is this space, okay? So that's that was the first hint that the string theory sees space-time differently from point particles. But in the tutorial, you didn't ask, or I didn't ask you to check that. But to check that, usually something interesting happens at the critical point or at the self-dual point, right? So what we want to do today is to check what happens at this point, at the self-dual point. Well, look at the formulas. Yes.
So, technically, we could also consider the radius r going from 0 to rc.
Yes, very good. Yeah. It's your choice. You could also say that you only like this and you want to remove this. That's true.
Okay, it's the same, right?
It's the same. Very good. Now, from here, we know that the critical radius is, in fact, one over square root of 2. Now, what happens at that radius? Something interesting happens for PL and P prime. Want to erase this because we can see what happens to them. Or the other way around. That's fine. Let's put a minus. Okay, that's what they become at the critical radius. That's where the theory becomes self-dual. Okay, so let's look at the mass formula. And consider the following state. Can anyone tell me the mass of that state? This is a state that has winding equal to 1, Kaluza-Klein momentum equal to 1, and it has n equals 0 and n tilde equals to 1, right? So let's put it in this formula. And see what we get. Yep.
Somebody said it.
So we get a new massless state. Well, is this the only new massless state that we get? Well, no. You can play the game of trying to see at this critical radius what are the possible choices for M and N that you can make so that you get a massless state. Well, you could try this one. Note that I'm satisfying this condition too, right? So I'm being careful to satisfy the level matching condition. Okay? So this one is also massless. We could also have this guy, and of course this guy. But that's it. Those are the only new massless states that we get. Okay. And we get precisely four of them. Four new massless states. Okay. Now note that they all carry an I index. So these are four new vector bosses. Massless. And what do they do in life? Well, they happen to combine with these guys to enhance once again, they behave, one of these guys, and one of these guys will be a simple root of an SU2. And this will be enhanced to SU2 cross SU2. Okay? So the bosonic spring at the self-dual radius when compactifying a circle will be a theory that not only has gravity but also has an SU2 cross SU2 gauge symmetry. Why is that important? At the moment, no reason whatsoever. Well, there could have been a reason, because before E-brakes were discovered, people might have worried that there was no way to get gauge groups. Remember, we only found, when in flat space-time, we only found U1 gauge fields, right? We said, well, we shouldn't worry about that. Somehow we will get them. We were more worried about fermions, getting fermions. We got fermions, but we also said that we needed gauge groups, okay? Well, E-brakes were discovered relatively recently. So before the discovery of P-brains, people worried about how to get gauge groups. And they realized that compactifying and sitting on the self-dual radius actually gave you interesting gauge groups. Okay? So this was one motivation for studying that. But that's not going to be our motivation right now. Our motivation is just purely academic at the moment. Okay. Since we don't have anything else to do, we have to make up all the time until 11:15. So let's continue along these lines. So let's consider the general case. So we want to compactify on R1, 25 minus T cross TV. So this is now a D-dimensional torus. Before we were doing D equals 1. Now we want to do a general compactification on a torus. How are we going to define our torus? Well, we're going to define it as taking D-dimensional real space, Euclidean space, and modding out by a lattice that is D-dimensional. So what do I mean by this lattice? Well, I simply mean all vectors in RD such that they can be written as linear combinations with integer numbers of some basis of vectors that I choose, which are linearly independent. Okay? So these guys belong to RD. This is just a standard definition. In RD or in R2, say you choose two linearly independent vectors, and you define a lattice associated to those vectors by allowing points in R2, which are any combinations with integer numbers with any signs. Okay? So you define the set of all those points and define that to be your lattice. Now, we define the torus to be RD modulo that lattice, meaning that when you draw the lattice, if you cross one point, you go back to the original, you go back, you can use these shifts to bring you back to a fundamental cell, like we did in two dimensions when we defined the torus last time. Last time we did it as a complex manifold at T2. Last time we did it with C, modulo some lattice. But now we're thinking about C as being R2. Okay? And we had two vectors, which we call complex numbers W1 and W2. But we don't want to think about them as complex numbers. We want to think about them as vectors, E1 and E2. Okay? So the idea is that if you move anywhere in R2, you can use the lattice to bring you back to the fundamental domain. And that's why this is topologically a torus. Okay? Because these points are identified with these ones, and these points are identified with these ones. Okay? Now, this is a d-dimensional generalization of that thing. Okay? Now, why am I doing that? Well, you can imagine that if I compactify on many directions, probably I can get very interesting gauge groups. In just on a circle, we got SU2 cross SU2. Perhaps we can get something much more interesting. If we want to study the spectrum, once again, if we take I to be the compact directions, so let's take them to be, well, we don't have to give a name to them. Okay, capital I will represent the compact directions, the directions along the torus. Okay, you can choose them to be whatever you like. So the torus tells us that X will be identified with any point that differs from it by an element in the lattice. Okay? So that's the identification we made. Just like we did in the bosonic string on a circle. And that means that we have, for every compact direction, we have a P left and a P right. Okay? That we can work out. And they turn out to be something like this, where these are elements in the lattice. Okay? So these are the elements of the winding along the lattice. So now we can have winding, say, we can have a string that starts here, goes up here, comes back here, goes here, and goes back to the same point. And this will be a string that winds on the torus many times in some particular direction. Okay? We could also have a string that winds only in this direction several times, Okay? But we can have combinations of strings that wind around both cycles of the torus. And in order to allow that, we should allow for general configurations of elements in the lattice here, which will come from here. Okay? So these LIs are elements in the lattice. Once again, we have the level matching condition. Which again means that this must be true. Okay. And now comes the clever part. The clever part is that it would be nice to do it somewhere here. The clever part of the story was done by Narayan, and that's why this is called a Narayan compactification. So he realized that in order to understand this compactification, or the space of different compactifications, just like what we did here, this looks very complicated as it is now. So if you're confused, that's good. I'm sure he was also confused when he looked at this. And he said, no, this looks complicated. Let's actually combine these objects into a single object. So he decided to introduce vectors that were just the union of these two vectors. So you put one on top of each other. So these vectors are actually living in R2D because each one of these guys was a D-dimensional vector. Now these big guys would live in R2D. Not only that, if you consider the set of all possible guys, okay, of all possible windings that you can get by varying the elements in the lattice, you will also produce a lattice. So the Vs also produce a lattice, okay? As you vary this guy in the lattice, and as you choose all possible Kaluza-Klein momenta. So he said, this is the physical lattice. This is really the lattice we should consider, not this one, because this one will encode winding and momentum at the same time. Okay? But what kind of lattice this is? Well, it's a lattice it's a two-dimensional lattice, so it lives in 2D. But what kind of lattice this is? Well, he said, well, this is a condition you want to preserve. Okay? So you want to preserve P left squared minus P right squared. So he decided to think about this as an inner product. In other words, he decided to think about this as the norm of this vector. If that's the norm of the vector, what's the signature of the space? Is what? Well, remember, this is a D-dimensional vector, and this is a D-dimensional vector. Yeah, the signature of the space will be plus, 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 minus, minus, minus. B of this and B of this. So we can refine this, and he declared that these guys are actually vectors that live in a D plus D, or some people call it B, D lattice. Okay. Very good. So what would be the next step if you're a responsible person doing a string theory 20 years ago? You learn that a string theory is not just this theory of nice actions that look very simple, del x squared or del x and so on, black worksheets and so on. Yes. You have to make sure that you have the constraints, you have to get rid of the negative norm states. When you go to the Lycom quantization, you have to make sure that Lorentz invariant is preserved. But we trace that back to conformal invariance, right? The residual conformal symmetry. So at the time, people knew that every time you did something in string theory, the first thing you had to check was conformal invariance, right? As I hope you also now know. Now, it turns out that conformal invariance imposes a very important constraint on this lattice. Not all lattices will give you a conformal invariant theory. The technical term for this condition is called modular invariance, but we're not going to discuss that. It's basically conformal invariance at the level, at the one loop level, okay? But it suffices to say that we know that all the magic of a string theory happens because we have this, and therefore we have to preserve it. And the condition for that is that these lattices have to be very special, and they are called, they have to satisfy a condition called that they are even and subdual. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, our lattice is already integral. What do I mean by that? Well, that if you have any two points, V and say V prime in the lattice, their inner product is an integral. So we already know that, basically from this condition. So if we work out what PL and PR right are, and we choose any two guys, we can show that our lattice is integral already, okay? But this is a special condition, even. It means, well, it means what it means. It means that I have to put a 2 here, okay? So the inner product of elements in our lattice, we have to be even integers. Now, this already means that the lattice is contained in its dual lattice. Do you remember the, do you know the definition of the dual lattice? If you have a lattice in condensed matter, say, the dual lattice is given by what? Yeah, so the way you define it is by saying, well, let me find out all the vectors in my space whose inner product with the original lattice happens to be an integer. So if my original lattice has separations 2, the other lattice will have separation half, right? Well, the fact that this guy, so this guy belongs to its dual because any element here with itself, well, with elements in the lattice, is an integer. That's the definition of an element in the dual. So this implies this. But we need more than that. For conformal invariance, we also need that this guy, the dual lattice, is contained in the lattice. And that's what it means to be itself dual. Now, mathematicians studied this for not, well, at least for a reason that is obscure to me. So they decided to classify all possible even dual, self-dual lattices. Yeah, I have no idea why. In fact, of any signature they did. So mathematicians studied, if you have D1 and D2, they classified all possible even in self-dual lattices. And they found something really interesting. They found that they can only exist, if D1 minus D2 happens to be 0 modulo 8. Such a weird thing. But 8 is a number that sometimes plays a role in what we have been doing, so maybe there is something interesting. Of course, these ones exist because this just is, this is 0. Okay. Not only that, they found that when it's equal to 8, when one of them is equal to 0 and the other one is equal to 8, the lattice is unique. And when the difference is equal to 16, there are only two lattices that are there. But, I mean, these are just random facts that you find in the math book and you find that they're amusing. Okay. This whole thing might look amusing. But okay, so let's continue. Remember, our goal is to find the analog picture to this one. Okay? What is the space of inequivalent compactifications of our string? Now, the space of inequivalent compactifications will be the space of compactifications where you change the lattice, okay? You change your lattice, and you don't change the spectrum. That's how we found out this duality, right? The p-duality. How can we change the lattice here? Well, we're going to change the lattice, but we have to keep this inner product because that's what controls the spectrum, okay? So what is a transformation that I can make on this space that preserves this metric? What would that be called? So let's do it here. A transformation in R2D that preserves this metric is called
SOD, D,
right? So if I apply an SOD, D rotation, I will get another string theory because I'm moving my lattice to another lattice, okay? But there is something interesting. So this looks like the space of compactifications, of inequivalent compactifications. I can start with one lattice and reach any other one by this process. However, I know that any transformation that keeps this bit is invariant and this piece invariant will not change the spectrum because the spectrum only depends on this and this, okay? So something that preserves only this part would be an SOD transformation, and something that preserves this part would be an SOD transformation, okay? So my space of inequivalent compactifications is not parameterized by the full SOD, D. I have to mod out by the action of that SOD on just the top components, which will not change the spectrum, and by the action of an SOD acting on the bottom components, and it will not change the spectrum. And this space is called the Narayan space. Okay? And it's the space of inequivalent compactifications on a torus of the string theory. Now, why did we do this? This will, in fact, give us the hint of the theory we're missing, of the theory we're looking for. How so? Well, I have to say that this is not the historical order, but it could have been the historical order. So keep these facts. These facts will be useful. If not today, tomorrow. But let me just mention a curiosity. Remember, we had our type 2A and type 2B theories. Well, let's just take type 2A. And earlier today, we were playing with compactifications of this theory on R1,5 cross M4. And we were playing with this space which is a Calabi-Yau twofold. We found out that it had to be a Calabi-Yau twofold, and the only interesting one is called K3. Now, it turns out K3 is a four-dimensional object, real four-dimensional, and it has an interesting topology. Inside the K3, there are two cycles, little two spheres, that cannot be contracted to zero. So it's like having a torus where you have one interesting one cycles, right? In a torus, you have two interesting one cycles that cannot be contracted to. Well, in four dimensions, you can have a manifold that has interesting two cycles. Well, K3 happens to have two cycles inside, and these two cycles can intersect, like the one cycles on the torus intersect. So people like to define the intersection matrix of these cycles. And think about many times where you can have a cycle and intersect it with other cycles, and they define a lattice for the intersection of cycles. So people like to define the lattice for the homology of this space, K3, for these cycles. I don't want you to understand this. This is a, maybe I don't even understand what I'm saying. So that doesn't matter, okay? I mean, all the mathematical proof that leads to this is an interesting theory. So we will have to sit down and study this carefully. All I want to say is that people studied that carefully and found out from mathematicians that the space of all possible inequivalent K3s, okay, which is more or less the same question we were asking here about the torus, but here the question about K3s, in the presence of a string theory, happens to be, so the space of inequivalent K3 compactifications of type 2A contains a factor that looks like SO 20,4 modulo SO 20 cross SO 4 times some other things, but the other things are not very important now. This looks just like this. In fact, this one satisfies the condition of being an even and self-dual lattice, right? Of coming from a gamma 20,4. Remember, what you needed was that one minus the other had to be 0 modulo 8. So this one is 16. That looks interesting. And remember, we compactify this in four dimensions. We compactify four of the dimensions. So there is a 4 here that also seems to be telling us something. Well, in fact, if we write this, there is an interesting way of writing this, which is very suggestive. It's as if there was some discrepancy, or there was a hint that there might be a theory where, remember, these guys came from the left sector, and these guys came from the right sector. Right? So these guys were from the left sector, and these guys from the right sector. This moduli space begs to be the moduli space of a theory where the left sector and the right sector come from different dimensions. One sector seems to be compactified 16 times before it meets the other sector, and it starts to be compactified 4 times together with the other sector. Okay? So the fact that we found this somehow hints that there might be a theory where the left sector and the right sector are different. Okay? Well, he's also telling you more or less what it has to be. Remember, we compactify 4 of the dimensions. So if we want to go back to 10 dimensions, we have to decompactify dimensions, right? Well, if we decompactify dimensions, so let's decompactify. Well, if we decompactify, whatever theory we find will have S of 16 plus 3 cross comma 3, S of 16 plus 3 cross S of 3. Okay? If we decompactify one of the dimensions, if we decompactify 2, we put a 2, and so on. Okay? So when we get back to 10 dimensions, we find that one of the sectors is completely decompactified, but the other sector is still compactified. In how many dimensions? So in 10 dimensions, we find, yes?
So I don't really understand what you mean by decompactified.
Taking the radius to infinity of a circle. Okay? So when we do that, we find that there, in 10 dimensions, the right sector is completely decompactified. So the right sector lives in 10 dimensions. That looks fine. But in order to reproduce this pattern, we need the left movers to be in a space that is decompactified, 10 decompactified, but still 16 compactified. Okay? These compact directions must be compactified on a 16-dimensional torus. But 16 plus 10 happens to be 26. Do we know any string theory that lives in 26 dimensions? Oh, holy. Yeah, we do. That happens to be the bosonic string. Well, do we know any string theory that lives in 10 dimensions? Yeah, the superstring. So what if we take the left sector of the bosonic string compactified on a 16-dimensional torus and the right sector of the superstring just in 10 dimensions and make a string theory out of it? How would you call such a string theory if it exists? Well, there is only one name for such an animal, right? That should be called a heterotic string theory. And I think I think we can do that. Of course. Yeah. This will not take more than 5 minutes. Because we know everything, we know every piece. We know the bosonic string, we know the superstring very well, so we are done. Right? So what do we have? In the left movers, we have bosonic string. So what do we have? We have these oscillators. And we have the internal oscillators. So I goes from 1 to 16, the compact directions, and mu is the index in 10 dimensions. Okay? Now the right movers, we will take them to be the ones of a supersymmetric string theory. So we need both guys. Okay. Now, I told you something interesting about the even and self-dual lattices. Now we know that we are compactifying this sector on a torus. And therefore, we get a lattice that looks like gamma 16, comma 0. Okay? We are not doing anything to the other sector. Now, mathematicians have studied those lattices and found that there are only two inequivalent lattices. So that's interesting. There are only two. They are completely rigid. They don't have parameters. So there is no radius to turn around. So when we compactify only the left movers, we have to sit on these lattices. There is no choice. There are only two. And these lattices, one is called gamma SO32, and the other one is called gamma A We can call it gamma EA cross EA. And guess what the names are telling you? They're telling you that these lattices are nothing but the weight lattices or the roots lattices of these Dinkin systems. These lattices we define in order to study the Dinkin diagrams. Well, those lattices for EA, it so happens to be even and self-dual, and it so happens to be the only one that is eight-dimensional. Now, if you want one that is 16-dimensional, you have the choice of having this one, mod Z2, the lattice of SO32 mod Z2. Or you can have two of EA. Now, I told you, these lattices are unique, and they are sitting at the self-dual point. Okay? So what that means is that the spectrum of the string theory on these lattices, every time you hit a root of this system, of these lattices, you will find a massless state because they are unique. You cannot mess up with the radius. Okay? They are all locked to the self-dual points. So what do we find? And that's how we end today, by saying that the spectrum is the following. We have our friends, of course. From the fermionic sector, from the superstring sector, these are the ground states that we can have. Now, from the bosonic sector, we get the usual vectors, and these guys are in the Cartan of these Dinkin diagrams, of these Dinkin systems. And these p squares are precisely all the roots. Sorry, p equals to 2. This p means the vector has length 2. And these guys are precisely all the roots that make up the root system of these diagrams, of these lattices. Now, why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting because you see that when you tensor these guys with these guys, what do you find? Well, the first guys here give us what? If you tensor this with these ones, this gives us our friends, the usual states, okay? The graviton, the B field, and the dilaton. Now, when you tensor this with these guys, you get the gravitino and the dilatino. How many of them do you get? We get only one, right? Well, this index, remember, this index is this index here. So we get only one guy. We don't get two, as in the type 2 superstrings. So we are finding a theory that has only one supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. That's starting to look something like we needed. And when we dot with these other guys, remember, this is a gauge theory index. So from this guy, we get vectors. In the adjoint representation of EA cross EA or SO32. Okay? And from the Ramon sector on these guys, you get all the gauge genus you need. Okay? So what we found, just as an accident almost, is a theory that contains huge gauge groups. Only two of them are allowed. And not only that, but also it has only one supersymmetry in space-time in 10 dimensions. So how many supercharges? And we end with that. If we only have one supersymmetry in 10 dimensions, how many supercharges we have? 16. So if you compactify my Calabi-Yau free fall, how many supersymmetries do you get in the end? Remember, a Calabi-Yau free fall preserves only a quarter of the supersymmetries. Four supercharges. Not only four supercharges, it gets four supercharges, EA cross EA. Inside a given EA, you can sit an E6, which has an SO10 subgroup, which has an SU5 subgroup, which has what contains a standard model as well. And from the topology of the Calabi-Yau manifold, you can generate different macro representations under the given groups that you have. Okay. So I think we should stop here today by simply ending and saying, well, this looks very interesting. So you can tell why people got so excited. I think people at the time, when they discovered this and found the Calabi-Yau compactifications, they thought they had done it. So they thought it was just a matter of months before they had completely solved the theory of the universe. I think it was the spirit of the time. And I understand. Imagine, you find a theory, it's a consistent theory of quantum gravity, it contains spectacular gauge groups, you learn how to compactify to four dimensions with just the right amount of supersymmetry, so you declare victory. Okay? Why haven't we done so? That's what we're going to discuss tomorrow.